Welcome to Are You at Risk, a podcast from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. Here are your hosts, Todd Scott with Joy Melbourne Griffin and Kiernan Waters.
Hi, everybody. We're back once again for one of our podcast discussions. I think we're still calling this program Are You at Risk? Do you guys agree? Does that make you can't
Sounds
nod
great.
During a podcast, Kiernan. You got to say yes or no.
I was waiting to see where you were going with it. Do we have other titles, okay. in the wings waiting? But no, Are You at
yes.
Risk?
Well, Are You at Risk? So maybe we should do a contest at some point and see if we come up with something better. So, by the way, I guess I should introduce myself again. I'm Todd Scott, the Vice President of Risk Management. And with me is two of my greatest lawyer colleagues, Joy Melbourne Griffin and Kiernan Waters. And both of us have seen a lot of stuff in the professional liability world for lawyers. So that's what we're here to talk about. Well, specifically, we're going to talk today about Joy. She just came back from Duluth, Minnesota, and spoke in front of the Minnesota State Bar Association's Solo Small Firm Practice Conference. And it's one of Minnesota's biggest events of the year for solo small lawyers. And you can imagine it's an event with a couple hundred lawyers from all over the state. And if you've never been to Duluth, Minnesota, Kiernan, I'm not sure if you've been there.
I haven't made it that far north yet.
It's a very miniature, tiny, iota version of Baltimore or San Francisco or any port city, but in our case, it's just on Lake Superior. So, but anyway, so Joy made it all the way up there, and I kind of felt bad because I invited her up as part of the planning committee, and I'm like, Joy will do a great job. She'll kill it. And they wanted somebody to talk about malpractice and malpractice trends. And poor Joy, she flew all the way across the country. And I guaranteed her good weather, and it was raining like crazy when she arrived. So, but anyway, and she spoke on malpractice trends. Joy, what did you think about your experience up at this event?
So, you know, I was actually coming from a different conference. So I was in a conference in Houston for a couple of days. And then I flew from Houston, okay, big city, you know, 100-degree weather, right? And I fly to Minneapolis, which I'm very used to flying into Minneapolis. I rent a car for the first time there. That was fun. And so then I'm driving, and it turns into, Kiernan, you would love this. So what's the first stop that I make ahead of a 2.5-hour drive?
Starbucks.
Of course. You know me.
Get that cold brew.
So, right.
I thought you were going to say Mall of America.
That's the second step. That's only when I'm with Kiernan. We tear that place up. So as I stop at this Starbucks, that's maybe, 20 minutes outside the city, the guy says, hey, where are you traveling to? And I said, Duluth. And he starts laughing. I don't know what that meant. Didn't know how to take it. But I get on the road, and now it's starting to rain. And I follow behind, you know, a couple of cars for a majority of the way. Some construction on the road, but this was the funniest part. So I'm driving, and I notice that I see a lot of places called Quick Trip and Holiday. So I said, you know, I don't need gas right now, but I'm thinking that Holiday would be the place to go to. My stomach starts growling by this point, right? Because now what has turned into what's supposed to be like a 2-hour drive is now like almost 3. Mm-hmm. And so Quick Trip billboards, this is the Virginian in me. It says the best gas station fried chicken you will ever have.
I beg to differ. Here in Maryland,
no way, no way.
You I did not stop, although I was very, very tempted. I just wanted you to know that.
Well,
but I get up there, and it kind of reminded me of Charlottesville. I had to drive through it was a small mountain, but a mountain nonetheless. And it was gorgeous because then it opened up to like this industrial site. You saw a lot of trains, coal cars. It was just beautiful. And it was a very quaint town. Most of the houses that I saw were basically embedded in the mountains. Beautiful, just just beautiful. The downtown area was, again, small and quaint. And then we stayed at Canal Park Lodge, literally the best view of Lake Superior. People were walking around the lake, trail around the lake. It was gorgeous. It was actually breathtaking to, you know, the beach girl is now at a Great Lake, you know, the one that you always hear about in history class or geography class. So that was a cool experience. And then the people there, they were so friendly. I heard more, oh, Minnesota.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, exactly. And there, here I come. Hey, y'all. How y'all doing?
Well. For those who haven't been to Duluth, Minnesota, I was kind of teasing. It's actually a really charming town, and it's where Bob Dylan came from, that area of the world and all of that. And it was a shipping town for years and years. So you're driving through northern Minnesota, and then eventually you kind of start to drive into – you come over this what Joy calls a mountain, but we don't have mountains in Minnesota, but you come into this area and next thing you know.
What is that?
Yeah, it's basically where if you turn off your brakes, you're just going to go straight down about 1,000 feet into Lake Superior. But anyway, from there you got this amazing view. And so anyway, and it's a great place to kind of hang out and bring your family. And so it was really great to have you there, Joy. And I'm just going to say it, Joy killed it. She did a great job.
Gosh, she
did the plenary there and was talking about malpractice trends. And so it's, you know, well, hey, we could, before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you're talking about, Joy, all three of us go to these solo small firm conferences around the nation. And frankly, we probably have opinions as to whether some people do it really good or better than others and things like that. So I'll just maybe ask you guys, do you have like your favorite event where you meet lawyers of that type that you go to? Kiernan, you got any, what's it like? I know you guys go to the Eastern Shore.
We have our big conference down in Ocean City, down at the Shorehun, as we say here in Maryland. But, you know, that's different types of lawyers from all walks of life. I would say the PLDF events that I've been involved in, those have been tailored to people, you know, attorneys in the professional liability defense area of law. And so that's really interesting. I mean, of course, I want to talk to them about malpractice, but even hearing some of the defense of, you know, doctors and other types of professionals out there, it's really interesting the commonalities between those types of professions.
Mm-hmm. Joy, what did you think? You can be honest. Don't worry. The Minnesotan here will only get mildly annoyed if you make fun of our event. No, I'm just teasing. This event, I'll be very. Maybe I should go first because I've been to a lot of these things.
Yeah.
Talking about the events that are geared towards solo small firm attorneys, and I think one of the best I'd ever been to. Well. It's in Virginia Beach, and I don't know if that's a solo small attorney event, but that's the one that you traditionally go to. And oh my God, talk about these summertime events where it's geared towards also bringing your family. And I think it's the only place I ever went where you'd have the, you know, the ballrooms where the events were, and then you could literally walk out onto the beach area where my kids were out, you know, playing in some sandcastle contest or something like that. And so Duluth, we had some train rides and things like that, but I don't know. So Joy, I know you're only in town for a short while, but what did you think?
So I think Minnesota nailed it on the head when it was geared towards the solo and small firms. Mm-hmm. I don't see that much. And you know, they are really the bread and butter, not just of MLM, but just, I mean, around the country. There are way more solos and small firms than there are attorneys at some of the mid-sized or larger firms. So the fact that Minnesota does take the time to acknowledge that and to do specialized training for those attorneys, I think it's really, really awesome. I don't see it too much around the country, so I really don't have a lot to compare it to. Mm-hmm. But in speaking of the Virginia State Bar, I mean, my girl helps me every year with the sandcastle contest. Unfortunately, the pandemic, you know, kind of took away from the families coming much, but in working with the Virginia State Bar, I mean, some of the best people in the world at the Virginia State Bar office, Maureen, who's retiring, she said, hey, come on back and let's do it and let's make it bigger. And I think we're really on track to trying to bring it back the way that you remember, Todd, with your children there. I know I invite my children to come and, you know, they're like, Miss Karen, look what I made. So, you know, it really is fun. It's a fun event. You can truly, just like you said, we left the president's reception. And I think, you know, Kiernan and I just kind of walked the strip for a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's nice when you're able to have events like this. I truly wish that a lot of the bar associations would tap into like Maryland and Virginia and Minnesota and just, you know, ensure that we can bring family, because that goes into lawyer wellness, too. Mm-hmm. Making it so that we can do things that incorporate our loved ones is really big on the priority list.
Yeah. I think the tradition of a solo small firm conference probably comes from, oh gosh, like if I go to the Nebraska State Bar Convention, I mean, most of those firms would be considered small firms. And so it has that feel to it. Same for Iowa. But some of the states where you have some very, very large firms, those who work at solo and small firm practices always felt like there wasn't enough for them. And so Missouri, I understand, is still one of the biggest ones. I don't know, it might have been a while since they get these kind of numbers, but I've heard, you know, upwards of 500 or 600 lawyers showing up for the summertime conference. I guess I would, too, if I was going to, what's the name of that resort, Branson? And those places in Missouri are where these things are held. And of course, they're all coming back after pandemic. So, Joy, you had the duties of talking about these malpractice trends. And I was actually kind of surprised when they asked, hey, would one of us come and talk? Because usually we're out there talking about a lot of things, but not often at these big conferences do they want like a plenary session on malpractice trends. But maybe that's a trend too. I don't know. You guys have to let me know if you're getting asked to do more of this kind of stuff. But anyway, so I was really, really glad you could make it for that. And why don't you walk us through it, when you were putting this together, what you wanted to focus on and what trends concerned you the most?
So, great question, Todd. I think that a lot of the research that we are looking at as far as malpractice trends are derived from the ABA Legal Survey report. That's the 3-year report. It comes out usually every 4 years, if you will, because it looks at a range. The last range that we had is 2016 to 2019. And so when that report came out in 2020, I think we're due for another report probably at the end of this year.
Actually, next month.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
thank you.
It's due to be released at the ABA's Malpractice Conference, which I believe is taking place in Vancouver this year. But we're just a little over a month away from when, I mean, they'll be releasing the data at that conference. So I believe the white paper will be ready for publishing at the same time. And it will be really exciting because 2020 to 2023 is going to fully encapsulate those pandemic years, which were especially hard on those solo and small firm practitioners. So it'll be really interesting to see how that compares next month with this data that we've become so familiar with over the past couple of years. And we've already started to see some of the trends, I think, that will be highlighted in the new set of data. Do you agree?
I do. I'm so happy to hear that because I've been trying to look and see if we were going to get some updates. Here's the thing. In the 2016, just like Kiernan said, 2016, 2019, we didn't have the huge pandemic, right? Mm. So the stats that we were seeing, we had a lot more substantive errors than we did administrative errors, meaning this is on the attorney more so of maybe giving general advice during a consultation, the filing of deeds and whether the deed descriptions are correct, separation agreements, seeing lots of claims in the area of family law where people felt that, clients felt that the attorneys were not grasping all of their desires in the final decrees. That differed from the administrative errors that we saw, where there was a failure to put a court date on the calendar that was usually done by staff. We didn't see those, although they were increasing per that report. So in generating this presentation, what I was able to do was take those statistics, but then also take the statistics from MLM. And using our claims over mm-hmm. that same 3-year period and extending it up until last year. So we were able to use some of those statistics to see how in the 3-year period, they were similar in nature, but they have increased over time. And yes, maybe it is, you know, due to the pandemic, dabbling. Huge increase in dabbling. Mm-hmm. I mean, you had so many criminal and civil practitioners who were not able to go to court because the courts were pushing back the court dates. And so they were like, hey, I got to get money. So they would dabble in one of the highest risk areas of practice.
Can I guess?
Yes, please guess.
Estates and wills and trusts, probate and admin, however you want to title it. But that is exactly where they went because there was a need, right? All the nurses, all the families dealing with sick people, everyone realized, hey, I need a power of attorney, if not a full estate plan in place. And those aren't documents. I think the tricky thing is, right, there's a lot of forms available for, say, a power of attorney online, right? But if you're just an attorney who has been doing, you know, DUIs for the last 20 years, you can't just pick up the power of attorney form and start charging clients $500 a piece because you think you can go right into this new area of practice. And that did result, and I think it still is resulting in a lot of claims against attorneys who tried to do that.
So break that down. Take what Kiernan said about the dabbling and having to hurry up and just get a quick $500 and doing a will. Compare that to the already increasing rate that we had of estates. So they were at a solid number 4, if you will, on the list of highest risk areas of practice. So it's ever increasing. I think maybe a couple of years ago, you could look at that as maybe number 8, number 7. So now the fact that it's at 4, let's just start there. Why is that increasing?
Anyone well, I think guess? It's squarely in the top 5 these days, right? Not only just number 4, but I think it's as a risk, you know, as a higher risk area of practice, it's going to remain in the top 5 riskier practices. Whereas, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 years ago, it wouldn't even have, you know, broached the top 20, say.
So do you want to guess why?
I know. I'm a recovering estate planning attorney.
That's so right, you know. Are. You do know, well, Todd. You want to guess?
I want to hear Kiernan say it because she's the one that practiced in this area. So
where do I even begin? Because there's a few reasons, right? There's a few things that are kind of coalescing at the same time or just coming together and creating a perfect storm. But the storm was already brewing. 2 words, right? Uh-huh. Silver tsunami. Do we know what that is? So that's, I mean, it's the baby boomers, right? So part of this is just the generation at the forefront is the baby boomers. Uh-huh. I believe they're what, like 55 to 78 or something right now. So they're people that should definitely have a robust estate plan and an updated estate plan in place. But along with the baby boomers, it's this massive, I think maybe the biggest ever passing of generational wealth. We also have a lot more ways for beneficiaries and family members to become litigious and to, you know, have these full out family, you know, inner family wars going on about who gets the china, or who gets the rocking chair, the, you know, the vintage piece.
Right.
In addition to all that, the last few administrations in the Oval Office have made sweeping changes to how the tax laws are enacted, both federally, and I'm sure states have been moving quickly to respond to their own state laws as these federal tax changes have been implemented over time. And there's talk about them sunsetting and whatnot, but these things are going to continue to fluctuate. So your estate plan is now super important because these baby boomers are the biggest generation, are quickly dying laying off or getting ill and needing family members to step in, trustees, personal representatives to step in and start doing this. Mm-hmm. And now because of these tax laws, because of the amount of wealth involved, and just because of the nature of living in 2024 and the avenues for beneficiaries to have some kind of feedback, we'll say, has just expanded greatly. So all these things are coming together when there's mm-hmm. already such a tsunami of this generation that's going to be inundating our courts with probate or with trust administration or whatever it might be. Uh-huh. So a lot of new things going on. Does that kind of summarize it
wraps
up in
it
a
up okay. to the T. The only thing that I want to add in terms of the malpractice trends, don't be so overly concerned, my fellow attorneys. It's not necessarily that it was a mistake that was made on the part of attorneys when it turns into a malpractice case. A lot of it is just what Kiernan alluded to. And it's the fact that there's a beneficiary who's upset that they were removed from a will or that they didn't receive the gift that mom or dad or whoever originally promised them. And so now when they do a will contest, us as the attorneys are being subpoenaed in order to verify the true intent of the testator. And so because of that, we call our malpractice insurance companies and we tell them that we need subpoena assistance, which most insurance companies like MLM provide. And so that's what is now increasing the numbers that we see across the country in those wills and in estate matters, wills, trusts, and estates. But now, on top of that, we've got this issue of dabbling in that area of practice. And so that was probably the most alarming statistic that I did have to discuss there. There were more. I mean, you know, Todd, you kind of heard me discuss mm-hmm. some of the formal opinions that have come out over the past year in dealing with the unauthorized practice of law. We know that some states are even allowing staff and paralegals to practice in that area. So it wasn't surprising that they started cracking down on those states that do not have laws of that nature. Mm-hmm. But in wrapping this up, the other issue that we did discuss are just some of the case law, the recent case law updates that came out. I mean, the egregious acts that some of the attorneys are taking with regards to business transactions and actually working with clients in business transactions, investing, taking money, taking loans from the clients, in handling personal family members' affairs, whether that be an executor or the trustee on a trust. I mean, just we have to be careful in forming those personal relationships because those are the ones that are newsworthy. And those are the ones that we end up talking about at these conferences.
I think we all agree that of these, well, I guess we're calling them post-pandemic trends because we don't have more up-to-date data just yet, but coming out soon. But we all agree that I think estate planning and all of that, it probably has us the most concerned. And it seems like a lot of firms, and this is typical when there's large changes in the economy, that a lot of firms will retool. And so you probably had people that suddenly saw that as an area where, hey, I can get more business and I can do this kind of work, but they may not have the experience to do that. So Kiernan, do you see that, you know, people that just aren't as experienced and, you know, what should they be doing?
Absolutely. I mean, we know, you know, under the rules of professional responsibility for every attorney, it's not that we can't try out a new practice area, right? If you want a career change, and some of the best defense lawyers used to be, you know, litigators, right? And vice versa. So you can switch sides and you can go into different, you know, areas of practice, but you have to do it thoughtfully and deliberately. Get a mentor, do research, take CLEs, whatever steps you need to do to be able to competently practice whatever area of law you want to practice. You just have to take those steps and do it in the right way, not just open your computer one day and say, hey, you know what, let me write a will. No problem. Let me Google a form. I think Susie Orman has some awful ones available for free online. So, you know, there are attorneys that might have seen an easy way to do things and thought, you know, let me try this. And of course, attorneys are smart. We can figure things out on our own. But there's just a lot of pitfalls, a lot of hurdles, and you have to be very careful in doing so. The other thing, Joy, that kind of stood out to me from what you were saying is that some of these economic recessions, Todd, you kind of tied into, hinted at this as well. Some of the economic recessions have caused firms and solo practitioners to rethink what they're doing. And I think we saw after 2008, 2009, a trend from back then was that that economic uncertainty resulted in more fraud and other egregious acts by attorneys who were, again, trying to, you know, keep their bills paid and whatnot. But we might see that again in the coming study next month from the ABA Quadrennial Study, because the pandemic and those years were really hard. And I think Ponzi schemes went up, some fraud went up. And, you know, especially it's always a struggle for attorneys to maintain their IOLTA accounts properly, right? We have to be so careful with the funds that we receive and the funds that are earned and when those funds are earned and when those funds are received and all that fun stuff that goes into that. But I think that there was a lot of activity in that regard going on the last couple of years that we'll see more of.
Well, I'll confess, I'm the oldest guy in this group here, and so I've been looking at these reports. They come out every 4 years from the ABA, and they're a great study, but I've been looking at them forever, and frankly, they didn't change a lot. I guess they started in 1985, and no, I wasn't working here then. I was still in high school, but they started out then, and so we always got used to looking at the report when it came out, and you'd see plaintiff's personal injury is the biggest piece of the pie for the most frequency of errors. And then real estate. And real estate sometimes is split in two, which is, you know, residential and commercial. And then all the business ones. And then, but always a little bit farther down where some of these, I guess what we're talking about here are these pieces that were just slowly been getting bigger over time. And we've talked about estate planning. I see criminal law is another one of those. It used to be just a criminal defense was a tiny sliver. These people were probably the last holdout of people that never even got insurance. They felt they didn't need it.
I hear that professional from time liability. To time from those criminal attorneys still.
It's like, right. I guess, what do they think? The plaintiff's going to be in jail, so what's there to worry about? You know, they're not going to get sued. But those, every time I look at one of these reports, that piece of the pie goes up a percentage and their defenses are going away. Things like that are happening. So lots of change, but mostly we're looking forward to the new report. Joy, I want to ask you, there was another thing you touched on up there, which is sort of the outcome of these cases, these matters. And you showed, I think they call it the disposition chart, where and usually people are surprised to see that if they haven't, because they just assume, oh, my God, if I get sued, that's the end of my professional life. But you already made that point, but I'm going to ask you to expand on it, which is that a lot of these things don't turn into anything. Not to say that you shouldn't worry about it, because it can still be costly, but kind of talk about, you know, what are the different types of dispositions and what's the likelihood that, you know, some lawyer who's been named as wrongfully or unjustly in a professional liability thing is actually going to go to trial or anything like that.
So just to kind of break it down so that our listeners understand, when we represent someone with regards to a malpractice action, it can be either an ethics complaint or what some people refer to as a bar complaint, or it can be a malpractice claim where an attorney is sued for some sort of wrongdoing. And that's when there's a whole negligence test, if you will, that's applied in order to distinguish whether that attorney was actually liable for whatever they were accused of. And so when we take all of those matters and we roll them up and just kind of determine whether we were able to come out unscathed or whether there was some payment or whether there was some reprimand, over 50% of all the claims under the ABA study, as well as MLM, were disposed of without any payment or without any reprimand. Meaning that if this was a bar complaint, it was either dismissed, or if it was a malpractice claim, there was no payment that had to be made. So why is this so important? And you kind of hit on it just then, Todd. It's important because if I'm a new attorney, especially, right, and I get this new complaint, if you will, I am scared half to death to even tell my malpractice insurance company. I don't want to tell them anything. The first thing I might think of, oh my gosh, how can I handle this myself so that I don't then have to report this and then they'll drop me? Well, number one, that's definitely not what MLM does, right? You get a claim the first time, we're going to hold your hand through it. We don't want you to think that you have to go through this by yourself. That's why we're so involved. That's why we contact you and we contact whoever defense counsel is if one has to be appointed. We're constantly checking to make sure that this case goes by so that you are unscathed as an attorney. And we do not punish for certainly just letting us know. We encourage early reporting because what do we want to do? We want to try to repair it before it actually becomes a big thing. And so that is the one thing that I really want all the attorneys to understand. Please let your malpractice insurance carrier know. By the time you've told a client that, oh my gosh, I might have done something wrong, that might be the biggest error that we can't bounce back from. So by simply letting your carrier know that you think something could be going awry and you think you may need some help, you can also be in that 50% where there's no sanction or there's no payment.
Well, I don't know about you, but I've seen lawyers kind of hit that freak out mode when somebody's accused them of doing something wrong.
Oh, yeah. Take it personally, right? It's only what you do 90 hours a week. It's your career. It's your, you know, self-image. It's how you hold yourself out. And you're the community attorney, right? If someone says someone's even going to believe or maybe allege that you've done something wrong or you don't know your stuff, you're going to kind of take it to heart and be a little upset, I would think. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, attorneys do really freak out at these, especially in Maryland. They usually, the Attorney Grievance Council or the Attorney Grievance Commission here usually sends these letters out so that they arrive on like a Friday or a weekend. And I think that's almost the worst part of it because like Joy said, like 50% of the time it's going to go away. It's going to be abandoned. It's going to be dismissed without any response even being necessary on the part of the attorney who's been, alleged of having committed some malpractice. But then it ruins your weekend because now Friday afternoon, Saturday morning, you check the mail and all of a sudden you're being investigated. And, you know, I think attorneys are kind of trained to always go to that worst case scenario kind of outcome. And so I think Joy's absolutely right. And I always reiterate, especially to the younger attorneys, the attorneys that are new to the profession, I don't want them up at night worrying that they're going to have a malpractice claim alleged against them that early in their career or that it's going to be such a negative impact on their career that they're going to have to find another career after a malpractice claim has been alleged against them. And that's just not the case. You know, we're certainly here to help you. This is really just part of the profession. Unfortunately, I think one of the other trends that we're seeing in this profession is that newer attorneys, younger attorneys, people joining the legal profession in this day and age, 2024 and moving forward, are going to have to deal with more malpractice complaints and ethics claims made against them. Again, just even if they haven't done anything wrong, it's just part of the profession. Similar to a doctor or an engineer, we have the ability to have a malpractice claim filed against us. And with everything like inflation, those things have been going up. So in the past, your career, you know, I think it was an average of like 3 to 5 claims made against an attorney over the course of his or her career. And I think going forward, we're going to see maybe 7 to 9 on average for any attorney. Not that they've done anything wrong, just that people get upset and people want to throw things at the wall and see what stick when they don't get the outcome that they wanted as a client. The other thing, though, and kind of bigger picture here, And something that is kind of concerning or really concerning across the industry, not for attorneys necessarily, but for us in the insurance world, is that we've seen these nuclear verdicts coming through after the pandemic for these malpractice cases, and really, really big ones, $100 million verdicts, right? You know, I think all of the major insurance carriers in the last couple of years have paid out over $50 million in claims. And like I said, that does go up where there were at least one or two $100 million claims that were paid out by major insurance carriers. So seeing the size of those verdicts is concerning for everyone in the industry, especially for us. And you know, think about the value of money that's at play in 2024. It's just, it's a whole new world than it was 50 years ago, certainly. So that's another trend that we're seeing, the value of these claims when things go truly badly. These have also been going on for the course of maybe years in some cases, things that have not been able to wrap up quickly, things that have involved many, many attorneys or many, many clients. And those nuclear verdicts are certainly giving us pause.
Do you think you've seen it all here working for a professional liability company? And then something new and crazy gets called in or walks in the door. And but in terms of, but the point I'm trying to make is, you know, if people got something on their mind or some clients accused them of something crazy, you know, we've been through this. And so it almost feels like when you work in the claims department, which I did several years ago, that you're almost kind of a counselor type too, because you're trying to talk people off the ledge. And, you know, lawyers don't do so well when they've been accused of doing something wrong, but we've seen it. And so usually there's that. But there's one other thing too, which is if you don't report in a timely way, and maybe we ought to make sure we make this point, you could risk losing your coverage. Any of you guys want to talk about that and what's about that and why it's required?
One of the things that I hated to do was to write a denial letter. Mm-hmm. And the number one reason why you might have to write a denial letter is for failure to report. And it's kind of what I was discussing earlier about if we think that we can do a better job in resolving the claim before we contact the malpractice insurance carrier, half of the time, we're going to mess it up even worse.
Take a big hole.
You know, I've seen countless times where an attorney would say, I messed up your case. This is what we thought your case was worth. So I would like to offer that to you. What? Please don't ever do that. You gotta contact your malpractice insurance carrier. Now, I will say that we will, you know, eventually have you contact the client, but we tell you exactly what to say. For example, some attorneys don't even realize that one of the things you're supposed to say is you're entitled to legal counsel. They miss that part. And now it becomes even bigger claim because they said, well, I didn't even know I had the right to an attorney. They didn't even tell me. So I thought I had to negotiate with this person that I accused of butchering my case. And so again, like Kiernan said, you're creating an even bigger hole. And when things like that happen, the malpractice insurance carrier has to say, I'm sorry, we can't even cover this claim because you didn't allow us to do that which we were supposed to do to even be able to help you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fair warning to the folks that are out there too. We all try to remind people whenever we can that, the malpractice isn't like a fine wine. It doesn't get better with age. You can't just let it sit back and it's not going to go away.
Nope. Don't sweep it under the rug.
Yep. And they do get worse and stickier the longer they're swept under the rug. So,
well, Todd, can I ask you a question real quick as we're on the subject? I feel like one of the trends we'll be talking about for the next few years might involve lawyers' use of AI technology. Do you think the world of AI and the world of malpractice is going to collide and what's the result?
Interesting. By the way, I almost mentioned it earlier anyway. One of the people at this conference also talked about legal trends. In terms of economics and law firm economics. And I think that Clio publishes something annually that's an economics report regarding attorneys in private practice, and it's really good. But anyway, about the AI question, somebody said that, you know, it's projected that in 10 years' time, there'll be half as many lawyers doing twice as much work. but in
singularity,
a good
way. I read something about that.
Yeah. And but it's not like lawyers working, you know, 20-hour days or anything like that. It's about the efficiencies that go with these tools. And so that's why I was up there to teach on some AI topics. And we're going to do a podcast on that topic as well coming up.
Good.
But a lot of it is, you know, the reason why lawyers can't ignore it is when you've got some things that are happening that will allow us to create that many efficiencies in our processes, it's going to we can't sit back and just let it miss the boat. We're going to start to embrace these tools and try them out. And as we've all seen, whenever there's something new, there's always sort of a lagging effect where, you know, it's like when everybody went to go work from home in 2020. And then all of a sudden you start to see the lagging effect of claims start to happen that we think are a result of just people in the law firm working farther and farther apart. Their mentor isn't just right around the corner down the hall anymore. Everybody was working from home. And so I think, you know, AI, you know, just bracing ourselves for whatever, as people start to transition to these new type of ways to process matters in the firm, you know, how are we going to do it without letting things slip through the cracks or putting out stuff out there that has mistakes, so they call them hallucinations. So I'll leave that till next time. I think we also have a program that we're going to have to do when this new report comes out. So Kiernan,
can't wait to dive into it.
I'm thinking, Kiernan, are you going to go to that event, that ABA?
No, I don't think I'll be there in person. But as soon as it is available for purchase or download or whatever, I can't wait to get into it.
Listen to us geeking out about a bunch of
there's gonna
pie
be some
charts
surprises,
and
though.
Bar charts.
Ask me 10 years ago if I would have been this excited.
We'll find out soon, Joy. What kind of lawyer would you be if you weren't doing this? But maybe I'll save that for another topic.
Yeah.
So, well, hey, thank you, guys. I'm going to wrap this one up. And we will thanks to Joy and Kiernan for participating again. And thanks to all of you for listening. And join us next time.
Are You at Risk is hosted by Todd Scott, Joy Melbourne Griffin, and Kiernan Waters. Production support by Carol Greethurst. Music by Audio Beats. Recorded and edited by Beth K. Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. For more information, visit mlmins.com. That's mlmins.com.